From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, welcome everyone. Another fast-paced, actioned 23 minutes with Robin Sachs, former prosecutor, robinsachs.com, and Robin Sachs on Twitter. And Robin Sachs, is there a new clothing line coming out?
Robin Sachs, wherever you want her, she is here for you, Dana Pretzer. You need me, I'm here for you.
I understand that there's no court today in the Conrad Murray trial, just so you could have the day off to go shopping. Is that true?
You know what? That's exactly what they were thinking. They're like, Robin needs a day, and she certainly needs new outfits to wear. Nope, not true at all, actually. It was a day of, first of all, there were some delays that started last Friday when the court abruptly got shut down at noon, and it ended up being at that point that there was a death in the family of the witness who was on the stand, the Dr. Schaefer, who was the anesthesiologist, who was expected to testify about the proper administration of propofol and whether or not it could be ingested or not ingested. And it was at that point that they were trying to decide whether or not court would resume Monday or not, given the funeral plans. There was also actually a conference that some of the doctors were going to. And since it was the last witness for the prosecution, they delayed till Monday, when then all of a sudden, apparently a Friday eve of trial kind of thing, the prosecution turned over some new information to the defense, which then became the cause for the court to delay today. You know how that goes. New discovery late in the game, automatic continuance, automatic delay, if not other sanctions or other types of remedies as well.
I was just about to ask you, is that going to be a problem for the prosecution with this late discovery?
Listen, it's not fair gamesmanship to turn over stuff late if you knew about it. But if it turns out, and it appears what happened here, is that they retested a sampling of, they did a toxicology do-over, basically. They decided that based on the questions on cross-examination, that they were going to go back and thoroughly check whether or not lorazepam could have been the cause of death, and could 8 pills of ingested in the defense's opening statement be the cause of death. So, you know, it's kind of a gray area here, because it is information brought forth based on the defense's theory that they didn't know beforehand.
Okay.
But yet at the same time, you got to kind of wonder why they didn't just thoroughly analyze the toxicology to begin with. There's lots of remedies, but excluding evidence altogether is the most severe type of remedy. So a court is not going to try, allow, or rule that evidence is going to be excluded, you know, unless there's only utilize that if that's the only remedy that's possible to cure the situation. And one day, going back, you know, this is the defense area of expertise, so how prejudiced they are by it is not so much, you know, it changes, the proof is still the proof. But if the prosecution anyway killed this evidence, then it's a whole entire different story.
That's why I love having you on here. You explain it much better than the mainstream media does. Robin Sachs is here, former prosecutor, covering the Conrad Murray trial for ET Online, I hear. And, of course, a regular correspondent here on the Scared Monkeys show also. Now, let's get to the final prosecution witness, death in the family. That's, you know, that's unfortunate. But will the prosecution wrap up tomorrow, you figure?
Oh, I do figure that is indeed the plan. I think that he took whatever the necessary days were off. And had there been any more witnesses that were expected from the prosecution, they would have just called that witness out of order and said, okay, we'll get back to Dr. Schaefer, let's put this next witness on the stand. So it's a clear sign that the case is going to be over with this witness, and the defense case is going to begin. And I'll tell you, the thing that's most interesting is that the tweet that came out today by Patrick Healy, who is a Channel 4 longtime reporter, saying that the defense has two detectives on their list. That's not necessarily surprising. They're probably calling to talk about best practice or try to impeach some of the officers or some of the other people that may have been involved. But, you know, it always gets really interesting when the defense folks start calling the prosecution-type folks witnesses.
Robin Sachs is here. We're talking about the Conrad Murray trial. Once the defense starts their time calling their witnesses, what do you expect from them?
Well, you know, the defense doesn't have to prove anything. It's not their case to prove their case in any shape or form. All they are trying to do is poke holes in the prosecution case. So it's to throw the spaghetti against the wall and see if it sticks. And frankly, if one jury they can get to believe that there was reasonable doubt in the cause of death, and one juror that they can get to believe there's reasonable doubt because it was a poor investigation, and one juror that they can get to believe that he self-ingested, and one juror to think whatever, that's enough of a soup for reasonable doubt to get reasonable doubt. So, you know, they're trying to make friends, and they do it by chipping away at little pieces. Excuse me, and that's what's going on with their case, but that's the overall strategy. Everyone says, you know, oh, there's a big change of strategy, they're going to do this. No, there is no strategy that do anything you can't. You know, where they can fault the investigation, they're going to fault the investigation. So they've done that through the prosecution witnesses in cross-examination, but what we're going to see also is clearly we're going to see that propofol could not have been the cause of death based on both the prosecution information on the no milky substance. You know, I'm sure you've already heard the CNN reporter who says, you know, if it's not milky, it's not guilty. and that's one version that's going to go out there. But then that's where they're going to bring the new lorazepam defense, that this is the way he actually died and it was not from propofol and all the reasons why lorazepam can kill you. And also they're going to talk about how they're probably going to have some best practices, some of their own doctors talking about what the standard of care in medicine is. Is it normal for a cardiologist to know CPR? They're going to probably have the one-handed cardiologist expert, one-handed CPR expert, going to say, oh, no, one-handed CPR is totally appropriate, makes perfect sense, and is, you know, definitely best practice. They're going to probably also have some home care physician there who probably talks about how celebrities maintain hospital-like environments in a non-hospital and how that's the best practice and how he did it. They'll probably have someone talk about that fabulous rinky-dinky pulsometer. I know that there's a fancier name for that, but that's what I call it, to talk about how that's perfectly as good as any other piece of machinery.
Sure.
And then, you know, then they're going to, you know, they possibly also, I mean, could talk about all the, not using necessarily using Jackson family members specifically, but utilize people who may have been around who knew that there were Jackson family members who got into that house before the investigation was completed, and how maybe that there was a greater framing of them that was going on, or framing of Dr. Murray by that family. That may come up too. So, you know, any number, all, you know, of those, it depends how much success they do with what they've got. They haven't really, you know, scored that many points in cross-examination, in my opinion, but, you know, reasonable doubt is a funny, funny thing. If the jury wants to find reasonable doubt, they will.
Let's talk.
You've seen it. I've seen it.
Yep. Let's talk about the jury a little bit. The Anthony case, it was all about the jury. Talked about the jury here, talked about the jury there. Were they paying attention? Did they take notes? All that sort of stuff. Your read on the jury through the prosecution's phase.
You know what? I have to say, I can't comment because I've been watching, just like everybody else who doesn't have a seat in the courtroom. I actually had a seat, and I haven't utilized my seat because I just can't get back and forth to the studio fast enough to do it. So I don't get the bird's eye view of the jury. But I can tell you that, you know, it's a combination. It's a jury lawyer recipe that's going on. And it's very, very hard to read. You know, I hate looking at the taking notes or paying attention or nodding the head or smiling or wearing pink or wearing blue or carrying a book or eating Chinese food over Mexican food. I don't really care about any of those things. But if your case is clean and makes sense and is presented as best as it possibly can, then all you can do is hope that the 12 people in the box who are our voters and our drivers are going to make a good decision and you give them the tools to make it. And I can tell you from looking at this case and comparing it to Case Anthony, I think that the prosecution has done a banged-up job here. I think that they have really made this unbelievably focused. It's not a It's not a stage for future careers. This isn't about high drama. It's about putting on the evidence, not letting the evidence and sloppy work get out there, you know, to the sloppy work that's been done, that's kind of controlled. They're raising the weaknesses of their own case from their own mouth. They have a nice balance between David Walgren and Deborah Brazil. And I don't think they're as cocky as the Casey Anthony jury was, I think, as the lawyers were. I mean, as much as I thought that they had an unbelievably strong case, I don't know that they showed their unbelievably strong case as much as I think that they're doing the job here. And I'm, you know, it's everybody I talk to here in L.A., I'll say the court of public opinion is like, are they hanging the doctor yet? Because as important as in my life, it isn't really getting the same attention here as O.J. We, you know, we in the media try to stir it up and get the interest, and we have, you know, definitely some of our folks interested in it, but it's not in any way close to O.J. land.
Yeah, for sure. Robin Sachs is here. Check out our webpage at robinsachs.com. Okay, we've talked about the jury. We've talked about the prosecution defense. What about the judge?
This judge, Michael Pastner. Now, let me tell you, this guy is a no-nonsense judge. He hasn't been from moment one. The fact that they had a foul to give in terms of time this week by allowing this little bit of a break here in this case. They've padded up this trial really nicely on time, and because of him keeping this trial on course and been uber diligent, they have had the ability to get to give a day where they're able to do that. So that's one thing. But the interesting thing with Judge Pastner, the most kind of crazy thing he's done, and I don't know that it's gotten as reported on as it should, is that he actually fined the DAs, each of the two DAs, $60 each, 10 minutes, $10 for each minute that they were late to court on a non-court jury day. So on Friday, when they were going through these motions, he actually fined them. And let me tell you, $60 for the DA's office, that's a lot of dough. You know that.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Now, when you get back to work tomorrow at the trial.
Do I do that anymore? I don't know.
Yeah. What do you expect to see?
I think that what we will see is Dr. Schaefer is going to get back on the stand. They're going to talk all about how propofol should be properly administered. They're going to pick up this case and end this case with the strength and fervor that they began. They're going to clean it up. And, you know, I think that they are going to, you're going to see them rest tomorrow. The only question is whether or not we're going to see any defense witnesses by the afternoon or not. And from everything that I see, starting at 8:30 in the morning doing motions today, there's no reason for the defense not to begin their case at 1:30.
You know, I would be remiss without talking about another high-profile case in your area. I'm making fun of it a little bit. Has Lindsay Lohan breached her probation, or does anyone really give a damn?
Oh, gosh, are you kidding? That's like my favorite train wreck here in Los Angeles. I'm so excited for her to go to court. But, yes, she's technically, she's not only technically in violation, she is in violation. But this is my theory of what's going to happen tomorrow. This is her first violation on her theft case.
Okay.
So Sean Chapman Hawley is very likely to come in and say, Your Honor, she's never violated her probation. On a first-time probation, no one would get any jail time, and they're going to try to bifurcate this from all of her old history. The prosecution's going to say, no, Your Honor, you have to violate her probation from all of these things. You have to look at her record as a whole and go back and look at all the times she violated. You said to me, if she violates her probation, you were going to send her to jail. And Sean Chapman will get up tomorrow and she'll say, Your Honor, you said that on her old case. You didn't say that on her new case. And really, if you're looking at this as a totally separate offense, which you're supposed to do, you shouldn't get time. But Stephanie Sautner is a tough-as-nail judge. She comes from a law enforcement background. She was a cop in New York. She was a city attorney here in L.A. She's well-liked both by the prosecution and defense. And I know that she's having scratching her head tonight, wanting to do the right thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Robin Sachs is here for another 5 minutes. Whether it's Lindsay Lohan or Conrad Murray or whatever the next case will be, is there enough media to cover all these stories, and is it right to be covering them the way they are?
Oh, God, we bounce that question around all the time. I mean, yes and no. I think that from a lawyer point of view, there's 5,000 lawyers, you know, here in Los Angeles for glomming to talk about it. These cases, but there's enough people to talk about it. The question is there enough budget and enough time to get the coverage that we used to have when we had, you know, court TV, gavel to gavel, 24/7, even within session, it's just not the same. But I think that based on, you know, it's a push-pull. I think with our, you know, when you look at these cases, there is an insatiable appetite for crime. Our friend Nancy Grace, Greta, all those people who make this their career. But I think the thing is that you have a constituency of the audience who love crime for crime, and then there's the people who pop in and out when it's a celebrity.
Yeah, for sure. Well, hopefully you enjoyed your time off away from the trial. I know how busy you are, and you spent some time with your family.
I have, and I'm looking forward to seeing them for dinner tonight before I go, you know, head on in tomorrow. And I'm really excited to go back down to the courthouse because I can go have my very favorite lunch in Japantown.
There you go. All right.
Right across the street from where all the reporters are staying at the old New Otani Hotel.
We'll talk to you soon, Robin.
Want to go see him.
Talk to you next week.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs covering the Conrad Murray trial for E.T. and E.T. Online. And, of course, go to foxnews.com to – or Fox News. Go to robinsachs.com to learn more about Robin and her law practice, former DA. And, you know, I'm making fun a little bit with the Lindsay Lohan comment. But, yeah, it's funny to see the media – especially in Hollyweird land down there, grab onto these stories. Conrad Murray, Michael Jackson, as important as that story is, you're going to see the media all over Lindsay Lohan like a bird on a bug. And is really Lindsay Lohan, the C-style actress that she is, her story that important? Well, it is. And will this judge send her to jail? I guess we'll have to wait and see. Now, we're going to take a break here on the Dana Pretzer Show, and we'll come back in a few minutes with Pat Brown, criminal profiler Pat Brown, you know Pat, to talk about the Amanda Knox case, Conrad Murray, and a couple of quick thoughts from her on this missing baby, the Lisa Irwin story. Fascinating, to say the least. And if you go to scaredmonkeys.com, you'll see that our old friend Joe Tacopina has got involved in this case. And I'll let you decide what you think about that. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. You all know criminal profiler Pat Brown. She's doing me a favor tonight, coming on a little early. Hi, Pat. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, Dana.
Nice to have you on the show. I didn't send you this, but I want to get your quick thoughts on the missing baby, Lisa Irwin, before we get into Amanda Knox and the other stuff.
Sure.
What, you know, if you look at the case, and some high-profile lawyers have got involved in it, Joe Tacopina, for example, from the Joran van der Sloot days. Here we have a mother says she was intoxicated, the baby's missing out of the house. Another sad story, just throw it against the wall and tell me what you think is going to stick.
Well, at this point, of course, there is no evidence of an abduction except that the child is missing.
Right.
On the other hand, there's no evidence that the parents did anything to the child. So unless the police come up with evidence one direction or the other, it sits there like, unfortunately, a number of missing persons cases, missing children cases. What's been kind of interesting, in my opinion, is the interview that Deborah Bradley gave most recently, where she said, where I put quotes around this, admitted she was drunk. Mm-hmm. At the time, was fascinating to me because, of course, that admission came after the lawyer came on board.
Right.
So we don't have any proof that she was drunk. So we just have her word for it at this point. So the question is, was she really drunk, or is she just, you know, claiming that because it makes a good defense in case there's something that was the parents were involved. In other words, it's the blackout defense. She just didn't know what was going on all evening long, so she has no clue about anything. What is most interesting to me is that she clearly did not tell the police this in the beginning. She certainly didn't say this on air to people who she wanted to look for her child. She gave incorrect times. And suddenly, all these days later, her memory has improved, and now she's admitting she was drunk and put the baby down at 6:40. And it's not making people real happy. I mean, when you know, she wanted people to look for a child. She wanted people to believe her. That's what she said at the beginning. You know, I'm going to be forthright. I'm going to tell everything. I want people looking for my child. But now, the problem is people don't trust her. You know, once you lie, people stop trusting you, and it's not a healthy thing to do if you're an innocent parent.
Criminal profiler Pat Brown's here. Some parallels to Casey Anthony. Yes, no?
I don't really see the parallels to Casey Anthony. I see the parallels to the Madeleine McCann case.
Okay, yep.
Because the Madeleine McCann case, when the child went missing 4 years ago in Portugal, Madeleine, what happened there was the crime scene had a supposedly open window and an unlocked door, and Kate McCann came out in front of the cameras holding a cuddle cat, which was Madeleine's toy. Now, not making any comment on that case, whether I think the parents are involved or not, it's kind of a repeat, isn't it? We have an open window, an unlocked door, and Deborah Bradley standing in front of the cameras with a cuddly animal. Now, it may just be coincidence. It may be that she's watched a lot of media. She says she has. She said she's watched parents in front of the camera before. She might want to do it successful. Certainly, you know, the McCanns, they're successful. If they're involved in any way, they're successful in not getting arrested. If they weren't involved, they certainly got a lot of publicity, you know, for their child, missing child. So whether she's innocent or not, maybe she's copying something there, how to be in front of the cameras. But she's now being caught with not telling the truth, and that's a problem. And she said something else which is really fascinating to me. This is the biggest red flag of the whole case. She said that her two sons heard some kind of noise, some kind of commotion.
Right.
And she hasn't questioned them about it.
Hmm.
And I'm like, excuse me? Wait a minute. Okay. Now, you know, now that you say you were drunk and you were totally unaware of anything, you're telling me that your two sons, you know, they're old enough to have, you know, be coherent in what they're saying. Your two sons heard possibly when your child was being abducted, but you don't want to talk to them about when that happened or what they heard. And that makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, obviously, she says, I don't want to, you know, stress them out. Well, these kids obviously stressed out. The little sister's missing. I mean, how is that going to stress them out any more than anything else is stressing them out? Why wouldn't you want to know what your son's heard? And what concerns me about that is perhaps the reason might be that the son's heard her. Perhaps at that 10 o'clock hour when she originally said she last saw the baby, and now she says 6:40 and 10 o'clock's out. But maybe they heard something happening in the home that was not related to the abduction, and she doesn't want to discuss it. And that's what it's coming out like. So it doesn't make the parents look good. It doesn't make it look like an abduction, and that's probably why the police are all over them.
Yeah.
Could it still be an abduction?
Sure.
Yes.
Yep.
You know, people do stupid things, strange things, but it's not helping matters. If she's innocent, she's, you know, certainly put up the red flags.
Yeah, they're popping up like a whack-a-mole game, that's for sure. Profiler Pat Brown is here. Let's talk about Foxy Noxy a little bit. Just when you think you've seen everything, but some people aren't surprised that she's out. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, this is a really confusing case, and I've been sort of reluctant to come down on whether I think she's guilty or not guilty, mostly because the original reports coming out of Italy, the stuff that we heard through the media,
right,
certainly didn't paint her in a good light. The fact that she, you know, said her boss was, you know, in the house, you know, in the apartment committing this crime. Why would you do that to an innocent person? The stories about her weird behaviors, the stories of, you know, with the cartwheels and then the kissing and the clothes buying, and then the part where she supposedly, when the police arrived, she and her boyfriend kept away from the door, and she said, "Oh, my roommate always locks the door," but then the other roommate said, "No, she doesn't." And the other story where the boyfriend called in the breaking and entering, and then he said nothing was taken, although the roommate wasn't back to verify anything like that. So how would he know? Those are the things we heard over here, along with the fact that supposedly the glass was on, you know, the broken glass was on top of clothing, so it looked like a staged crime, and so on and so forth. And she admitted to being there at some point in the interrogation. Now, that's what I heard originally. If we go by that, they're looking pretty guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the DNA evidence isn't very strong, they're still looking really guilty. They also supposedly lied about their alibis and so on and so forth. But since then, I've heard stories where some of this stuff may not be true. You know, that the police interrogation may have been such that they said, you texted Lumumba, your boss, you know, see you later. And, we, you know, did you see him later? Was he there? And she was pressured and she just lost it and, you know, agreed with them. And, you know, you hear the other side.
Sure.
That the media hasn't properly stated it, or the translation from Italian to English wasn't so good, or perhaps we're just, you know, getting a filtered view. I don't know. And because of that, it makes me sort of sit on the fence on it. And, you know, I just, if I could go and review every single shred of evidence and know that I'm getting the straight story, I might have a stronger conclusion. But I think that's where most people are. You know, they're either believing the first round of media, the second round of media, believing if she's guilty or not.
Well, I was just about to ask that about how big the media was in this case. Obviously huge. Another case that's being covered by the media, like we've never seen before, although some are saying it could be covered even more, is Conrad Murray. Been off for a couple of days. The craziness will continue starting tomorrow with the defense. Your thoughts on the prosecution? How many points did they score?
Well, I think they're doing pretty well. Of course, I thought that was the Casey Anthony case. I thought the prosecution did a great job. I was, you know, when Jose Baez came up with all his bizarre, you know, she was attacked by, you know, her father molested her, which was, you know, and he told her she was going to go to jail, and he helped. I'm like, where does that crap come from? You know, who would believe that? Well, obviously the jury. So, you know, I certainly couldn't see where the prosecution failed in that case. Yeah, it wasn't, maybe they weren't perfect, but, you know, they had so darn much. I'm sure they never thought this could go that the wrong way. In the Conrad Murray case, who knows? The same thing, you know, can play out. You know, sometimes when you have a prosecutor stand up and he does his bit, you think, yeah, yeah. And then you think the defense stands up and goes, yeah, yeah, you know, and you go back and forth. And a lot of our juries are going on, unfortunately, I think a lot of times emotion and a lack of understanding of evidence and law. So I think they're doing an okay job right now. I don't have a problem with it. I find that Conrad Murray really has no excuse for his behavior. You know, he's a doctor. I mean, you're supposed to first do no harm, right? I mean, that's the oath you take, you know, and how is it doing no harm to privately administer all these kinds of medications to a person who shouldn't be taking them? I mean, right there is a problem. And then, of course, his behaviors that particular night, I mean, they're glaring. And whether the defense can spin it enough to get him off, I mean, that's a good question.
The jury system itself, we've talked about it before, you and I, you get the people to sit down and listen to the technical testimony, become experts in 3 weeks or a month or however long the trial takes. How much will the jury system be scrutinized after this case like it was in Anthony?
Well, I guess it depends how it all plays out. You know, I've seen so many bizarre jury decisions recently. I'm just appalled at what I see. People getting off who just definitely shouldn't have been getting off. Seen it go the other way, too, where there's hardly any evidence and they convict the guy because they simply don't like him. You know, he's some lowlife, and they go, yep, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we don't care. He did it. I've seen it go both ways. Very frustrated both directions because I think, you know, when you put a person who didn't commit the crime in jail, prison, maybe he's a lowlife, maybe he's a psychopath, maybe he's even done a lot of bad things, but you leave the other guy out there. You know, you leave another guy who's really guilty out there. And, of course, vice versa, you're putting people who are guilty on the street when you let them go. So, I mean, I have a big problem with the jury system just because I cannot understand how we can put, in this day and age, so many untrained people to make a final decision on something which they don't have any training for, especially when you have the experts these days coming up with all the scientific stuff. I mean, I feel, in a way, I feel sorry for the jury because you're sitting there and, you know, the prosecution puts on its witness and they say something about the blood spatter pattern. I think I remember this in the, what's his name, the music dude?
Phil Spector.
Who? Spector, was it?
Phil Spector? Yep.
I mean, It was amazing, the first trial, because, you know, you had the prosecution saying one thing about the blood spatter and the way it had to be, you know, he had to have been holding the gun. Then the defense gets up there, and they had, you know, more expensive one, mm-hmm. more expensive expert, and he said the complete opposite. Now, both of those things can't be true. You know, even talking about science like that, both of those things can't be true. So somebody is either lying or manipulating or, you know, doing something, or they're unqualified. But which one is the jury supposed to believe?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got two experts with backgrounds, and you think, oh, I don't know. You know, and they don't have a background in it to say, hey, this guy's full of crap. You know, he's just telling a bunch of junk. And I thought the defense in the case of Spectre, I was shocked when I heard the defense expert speak about the blood. I'm like, heck no, I know better, and I've read your dang book. I know you know better, but you just got $50,000 to testify whatever the defense wanted.
Yeah.
I think that should be, there's something wrong with that whole system then,
yep.
that we would allow people, you know, the experts to get up there and not tell the truth, essentially.
Will it make a difference, Pat Brown's here, to not have sequestered this jury, or is that just overrated?
You know, I don't know. You know, it goes both ways. I think sometimes when you sequester them, it gets surly. You know, they get fed up with being there. All they want to do is get out.
Right.
And they're still talking among themselves. I don't think they're that ignorant of what's going on in the world outside, especially when you have all that information before they even go to trial. And you know, anybody who says they don't know anything is either lying or living under a rock. And, you know, so, you know, I think it's probably, sometimes I think it's not the greatest idea to sequester, but I think we need a professional jury. I just strongly believe in that because I think we've gotten to the point where our jury system is unable to handle the cases anymore.
That's for sure. One last question. The whole doctor shopping, Hollywood, you know, you go to back to Anna Nicole, hell, go back to Elvis. Will this case of Conrad Murray, Michael Jackson, bring more light to how celebrities are looked after, so to speak, by the medical profession in some cases? Or will there just be another case another time?
I think it's going to be another case another time. I mean, in theory, you have the right to have a private physician, and if the private physician is only working for you and you got the money, I suppose he can work for you. You know, I don't know that there's anything in our laws that state you can't have a private doctor. But I think that if that private doctor if there's abuse, I mean, he should be losing that medical license. Just the stuff that, in my opinion, Conrad Murray was doing, I think he just was there for, you know, he's making big bucks. And one of the problems that people don't sometimes realize, when you're working for a celebrity, and we see this in homicide cases too, you know, when somebody goes to a house where the people are very wealthy, they get, the police sometimes kind of, you know, wow, you know, you're at a celebrity's house, and it's hard to function the same way you might function with regular people. You know, you get awed by them. So, you know, you're working for Michael Jackson, and, you know, he's so powerful, and he's paying the bills. So are you really truly honest with him? Are you really doing what's right? Are you doing what he wants because he pays the bills and because he's Michael Jackson? So I think that your ethics can fly out the window under those circumstances because you're being bought. And I don't think that's a very healthy thing. And I think, you know, Conrad Murray chose to be bought. Well, they should lose his medical license, but I don't know that we can stop people from, you know, working privately unless somebody can prove that they're, you know, committing medical malpractice.
Absolutely. Pat Brown, always a pleasure. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks, Dana.
Bye-bye. That's criminal profiler Pat Brown. Check out our webpage. Take a look at the show notes. You see Pat on Nancy Grace and other shows. And, yeah, the jury system itself, will it be scrutinized as much as it was in the Casey Anthony case when this decision comes out? I don't think there's a lot of Conrad Murray fans out there, as many as there are Michael Jackson fans. So we shall see. We're going to take a break and come back with crime blogger Blink. Say that three times real fast with her part two on the Morgan Harrington case. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. I got to type in this website. BlinkOnCrime.com. BlinkOnCrime. See, I got to add a few minutes to the show here because we're running a little bit, you know, it's not going to work, is it?
No, how funny is that? Oh, can you go an extra 6 minutes? Is that a real question?
Blink on, okay, all right. BlinkOnCrime.com. 2 years cold, the Morgan Harrington murder. Two women, two locations, too long. We did part one last week. Part two is here. Blinkster, what's going on? You have a fascinating story on your website.
Well, I'll start backwards, if I may.
You may.
What happened is the the two-year anniversary of Morgan Harrington's disappearance was on Monday, the 17th of October. And you and I had, you know, we've covered this case fairly often over the last 2 years. As you know, Morgan was found after being missing from a Metallica concert October 17th on January 26th in 2010. And where we are is her family has filed a lawsuit against RMC Events, who is one of the security providers for the John Paul Jones Arena, which is on the UVA, University of Virginia campus. And that got some flack, of course, you know, but these people are looking for answers in the unsolved murder of their 20-year-old daughter. And there is every ounce of evidence that she was denied entry by RMC Events back into John Paul Jones Arena, as well as potentially asked to exit the arena based on the fact that she had a camera.
Hmm.
So we have a series of events, and you know, I don't want to speak for the Harringtons, although we're in constant contact, as you know. I don't want to, I'm not, you know, they have attorneys, so I don't want to speak for them. But I can tell you that they're looking for answers. This is not about, you know, resolution or restitution. This is about the fact that they have not been given information that they, as parents of Morgan Harrington, deserve about how she came outside of the arena and ultimately how she left the grounds. And certainly that's very important information for parents to have, of course.
Yep. Now, when I interviewed them here a while back, you're right. That's exactly. They're looking for answers. But let's focus a little bit more on the refusal back into the arena. And again, there's some litigation in coming forward and all that sort of stuff. But let's talk about that. How big of an arena? How many people does it hold?
Oh, Dana, 16,000.
Okay. You can't tell me that one young girl, I'd be curious to see the stats, if they kept them, about how many people were turned away because of cameras, that you go to any concert and you'll see the flashbulbs going. That just makes me heartsick.
Well, more than that, you're exactly right, Dana, but more than that, I can tell you, I can pull up YouTube, full concerts.
Yep.
For Metallica, from that venue, maybe 10 or 15. We actually believe we've actually spotted Morgan on somebody's camera phone and turned that over to law enforcement fairly early. Now, as you know, a camera phone in a venue of that size is grainy, but through process of elimination, you know, there was only one other girl that resembled Morgan who happened to be a peripheral friend, not Morgan's friend, but friends of friends, if you will,
sure,
that had been confused with Morgan a few times that night. The reality is 16,000 people in an arena, and you can't, and cameras in the lots adjacent all the way to a half mile down to the bridge where she was allegedly last spotted, you can't tell me there isn't any footage of the girl.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the mind-numbing part about this. Okay, let's get back to the case itself. The recovery, the forensics, the investigation, let's take those 1, 2, 3.
Well, what I'll say is that, as we've discussed, Morgan was discovered on Anchorage Farm, which is now known as Anchorage Farm, on January 6th, 2010, by the owner, who is David Bass. There was significant weather in the area, which had uprooted telephone poles and trees, and that particular area is serviced by cables that are on a telephone pole. It's not underground, as you see in some developments. But that potential damage to his farm was the impetus for him to drive a tractor out into the region where Morgan was found. And what I can tell you is Morgan was found in a hollow on a 700-acre farm, which is literally maybe like a 30% downgrade from a hayfield, so badly that they rarely cut the hayfield. It's a creek bed. So for an individual to put her there and traverse that type of environment at night with no prior knowledge of the land and no light is nigh on to impossible. This is somebody that's local. This is somebody that has been on that property that had a level of comfort to position her there without any means to hide the crime, by the way. Law enforcement that was on the scene initially, through our sources, was not sure that this was a homicide. It was that blatant. And obviously, until they, you know, examined her remains and the effects that were, you know, with her. But from a, you know, from a profile perspective, this individual was comfortable enough with this land that he did not think she was going to be found for a significant time amount of time. And moreover, there was a, you know, a 50-person slumber party that took place on those grounds a week later. We have pictures of people traversing that farm. And the question becomes, was she there? Or was it that good of a hiding spot or, you know, a recovery, you know, for lack of, I'm not, I don't want to be, you know, graphic, but was it that good of a place to put someone that she would not be recovered
right.
for the 3 months that she was there? Either way, you slice it. This is a local person.
Right. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. When I bring up forensics, most people, lay people, think of DNA. Let's talk about that.
Well, there is, I wasn't prepared to talk about this, but another entity released information that I would call case sensitive, but it came out, so the cat's out of the bag. Here you go. The shirt that Morgan was wearing, which is tied to her through a DNA connection,
right.
and is tied to the suspect, who is also tied to the 2005 Fairfax sexual assault case. They are tied together through DNA. So suspect's DNA is on the shirt that was found on that bush on, you know, arguably November 5th or November 11th of 2009, prior to Morgan's discovery. So we know that we have her shirt that she was definitely wearing that has a DNA connection to a perpetrator. And the thought process on that is we want people to understand that this individual was wounded, meaning Morgan likely defended herself in this attack.
Mm-hmm.
So we are looking for somebody that has an injury, and we don't know how great it was or where, but important to note that in the 2005 attack, that victim also defended herself to the point where she scratched this individual's face, and that's where the DNA comes from in that profile. So, you know, what do we know? We know that, you know, a serial offender who is likely a sexual sadist, because that's his MO. He's attacking women from behind. He engaged this woman. We talked about this last week. He engaged this woman, said, hey, I'm waiting for a ride. So, you know, was that a barometer check? You know, whether or not she was going to fight back, things that we know of that sort. Did he do the same with Morgan? Because she was in a parking lot by herself, without a ride, without a coat, without keys, without, you know, a phone, potentially, at that point. And you have to believe this girl, you know, not every girl is like this, and I'm not saying that, you know, she's different than anybody in that situation, because I don't know.
Right.
But the likelihood, based on her interactions, of her taking a ride with an utter and complete stranger after refusing other attempts for help does not make sense.
No. Blink from Blink on Crime is here talking about her article, 2 years cold, the Morgan Harrington murder, two women, two locations, too long. I always hate bringing this up, but I'm going to bring it up anyway because it's a factor, I think, in this case. Those are my words, not Blink's. Let's talk about law enforcement jurisdictions, capability, and maybe ego.
Well, that's an excellent question. First of all, the UVA Police Department is the most recent police press release was on Monday, on the 17th, and it should be noted that It does not include that the university police are assisting in this case, even though they were the initial agency. And that's for good reason.
Right.
There were mistakes made. I outlined in my article that, you know, months after Morgan went missing, prior to her being recovered, a contact of mine was in a meeting where they were discussing flat-out misinformation in the case. And there's no explanation for that whatsoever. Within that parameter, we have, as it relates to what you and I just talked about, which was the lawsuit for the Harringtons bringing against the security agency, RMC, in the initial release of Special Agent Dina Capuzzo he's a special agent for the Virginia State Police. What he said was that Morgan was denied re-entry because she was told that she had to purchase a new ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Well, according to this lawsuit and according to the president, Dan Schmidt, of RMC Events, it is just their policy to deny re-entry. Morgan was never offered to purchase another ticket to get back in. Had she done that, she would have bought one. She had the means to do so. And the question becomes, was she injured? Did they know? She was outside. She tried to get back in. Under what pretense? Who's responsible? Did any of that change, you know, the possible outcome? I guess the answer is we really don't know, but you have to know. Because how do you protect the next person if you don't know what you did wrong? So we have a situation where we have the lead investigator and his boss. His boss is retiring in early December. You know, I'm sure that probably set you back, Dina, because you and I know that when a cop has or an investigator with this amount of, you know, background has a high-profile case, how many are you aware of that retire?
Exactly, yeah.
In the middle of it.
Yep. Good point. Good point.
She deserves everybody working together and saying, you know, I profiled in my case, and you and I not talked about this specifically, but in the case of a guy by the name of Michael Lee Jones, I had a YouTube, Vanity Fair covered it very, very well, of a gentleman who worked for, you know, a food service company that's also, by the way, contracted by UVA and John Paul Jones and other institutions throughout the country. That's how he was caught. And he was caught by a detective that was not so sure he was the guy, and a private investigator that was hired by the hotel where he was staying. And to watch those two work together, to watch a detective allow a private investigator, now a civilian, who was a former police officer, solve his case for him, is something, it's magical. They worked together. There was no ego. There was no, you know, it's my case. I don't want to hear what you have to say. They were all about putting a bad guy, who turned out to be, by the way, a serial rapist, with these opportunities. Had these people not worked together, he would still be out there. And they put him away for life. And that would not have happened. He wasn't even going to serve a year in the first offense that he was caught by. Luckily, they got his DNA, and then they put it into the database, and of course, these hits came and went. And that's how he's serving the time that he's serving. But had that not happened, he would still be offending, and there would be more victims. And the Harringtons, you know, you and I, everybody, that's our goal. We want to see that not happen to another girl.
Yep. No, that's so important, and, you know, like you say, and like I'm just going to say, there's no I in teamwork, and the basics of a good investigation when you have many different agencies working and many different people. Put the egos in your pockets, work together, and get justice for the family and for the victim. That's the important thing. Where's this going to go next, Blaine?
It's going to go, as you know, when, you know, the talk of lawsuits happens, everything kind of freezes, like as almost in slow motion.
Yep.
And everybody kind of does their assessment on, you know, what's our liability, where do we go now? At the worst case scenario, And I say this because we feel fairly comfortable, and you and I have discussed, that we've got a pool of issues within the University of Virginia and John Paul Jones Arena that are safety hazards, if you will, first. And that needs to be addressed, because whether or not it has to do with, ultimately, with Morgan's case, we have a problem. So that's number one. I happen to think that that's going to lead to a potential pool of suspects that need to be looked at. Number two, there is a very real issue that the only way to address not getting answers in Morgan's case is through a lawsuit, is through discovery of a civil case.
Yep.
And so, and we've seen that so many times. What have we learned about cases that we never knew before? Because that in itself delivers almost the only option for a family that's asking for answers. That's going to happen in this case. It will be, you know, RMC is the start. Because as you and I know, when you're determining negligence, that goes in percentages. And when you have a percentage of security supplied by one vendor, which in this case would be RMC, you have to address the fact that the other security avenues are through their own police department, through their own surveillance, through their own closed-circuit monitoring. All of those things relate to the disappearance of Morgan, and they will need to be addressed. So this is probably going to be, well, not probably, it's going to be the fired first salvo in preserving the options for this family to get the answers that they need. The best case scenario is everybody's going to realize, you know, this family means business. They're concerned about one thing, and they would tell you this. They're tired. They're bereaved. They're trying to do right by their child in the ways that they want her remembered, but they can't even rest on that laurel, if you will, because they fear that there's going to be an ex-girl with good reason. And right. In their good conscience, they feel obligated to stop that from happening. And they're really just asking for everybody to work together to say, you know, for them, justice is important, but it is not nearly important to them as preventing another family from going through this. I mean, and you know, how amazing is that?
It is totally amazing, and you know, my heart bleeds for them. But what we all need is answers for this family, and we'll keep plugging away, and hopefully, law enforcement will come up with some. I know you can get answers at blinkoncrime.com. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Mine too. Thank you, Dana.
Bye bye.
Bye.
That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Check out the webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can pick up past shows, podcasts of commentaries, listen to the show live, leave comments. And for those of you watching on Access Channel 7, we'll see you again and real soon. And, of course, at Scared Monkeys Radio and at scaredmonkeys.com. Good night.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.